To say happy Mother's Day to all those of you who are mothers. I very rarely get an opportunity to call my mother earlier in the day because of how early I get here on Sundays. So, Mom, I know you're watching. Happy Mother's Day. I'll call later. And we are good today in yet another. It always seems to happen this way. There is always something awkward on Mother's Day about mothers. It's gonna be a weird one. We're gonna do it again. I do not do these on purpose, I guarantee you. But here it is. We are gonna be back in 1 Samuel. We are doing our Return to the King series in 1 and 2 Samuel as we work through. We're in chapter 4 this morning. And before we start, I want to talk about one of my favorite things on the planet. Major League Baseball. It is officially baseball season, and it is in full swing. And if you don't know anything about Major League Baseball at all, that is perfectly fine, because I'm not going to be talking about baseball today, but I'm going to be talking about something that is true of every Major League Baseball player. They are as superstitious as anybody else on the planet, and some of the things they come up with is just downright lunacy, craziness. Baseball players are incredibly superstitious. Here are just some of the superstitions that have existed throughout the years in Major League Baseball. Mark Teixeira, he was a first baseman for the New York Yankees, and he had this superstition that anytime he was playing in a baseball game, he had to wear two different socks. If his socks matched, he believed he would never get a hit, that the game would go badly, and that he would not be able to win any game if he was not wearing two different socks. Most of these probably just come from it happened once and it went well, so then they did it forever, but this is one that is not even the closest to the weirdest on this list. For example, Jim Leyland, he was the manager for the Detroit Tigers for a while. If they were on a winning streak, in order to keep those winning streaks going, he would not change or wash his underwear the entire time of that streak. Probably a good thing that he was a manager in Detroit. They didn't have too many winning streaks. Just weird, right? So Matt Garza, another player, he has to eat Popeye's chicken before every single home game, which, if you don't know, there are 164 games in a year in baseball. That is a lot of Popeye's chicken for somebody who is in really great physical shape. Popeye's chicken. I don't know how that became his thing. Wade Boggs, one of the greatest hitters of all time, he always took his batting practice for an evening game, had to take batting practice at 5:17. He would rush other players out. He would move other players out of the way. He had to take batting practice at 5:17. Otherwise, they were going to lose the game. He was convinced of it. He had to do batting practice at 5:17. Ken Griffey Jr., one of the most famous outfielders of all time, at one point was on a slump hitting. And so he took the Mercedes-Benz that he had purchased, and he decided, this is what he said, this Mercedes doesn't have any hits in it anymore. So he had to sell it and get rid of it so that he could start hitting again. He had to get a car that had hits in it, was how he said it. Just lunacy. Turk Wendell. Turk Wendell, he's one of my favorites here on this list. He had to make sure not to touch the foul line. And that's not abnormal. That is actually one of the most core beliefs on a baseball field is the foul lines. You are not allowed to step on the foul lines. You teach this to little leaguers. This is so ingrained in baseball. When you go onto the field or you come off the field in a baseball game, you cannot touch the chalk line that denotes the foul line on either side of the field. Turk Wendell took this so far that you would actually watch him. If you go back and watch some of the historical film of him playing, he would come and not touch the foul line, but on either side of the foul line, there's about 1.5 feet of dirt. He would leap over those 3 feet of dirt to make sure he did not touch the foul line running on either side of the field. Now that's a little crazy. But Turk didn't stop here. He had this obsession with the number 99. He wore the number 99 when he was playing, but the team he played for actually wanted to offer him a contract for $10 million to play the game of baseball. And he said, no.
I want you to short that by one penny. I want you to pay me $9,999,999.99. It has to be all nines. He was so obsessed with the number nine, and he thought the number of nine was going to be the thing that allowed him to win at baseball. So he took a penny less in his salary to make sure that he had as many nines in his life as he could possibly get. Weird. But still not weird like Turk Wendell, this baseball player who had these many, many crazy things. Every time he would go out onto the field to play his position, he would take four pieces of black licorice and shove them in his mouth, and he would chew on these pieces of black licorice the entire time he was out in the field playing. The thing that makes this even weirder is every time he would come off the field from playing, he would spit out those, or if he had finished chewing them, he'd swallow them, get rid of those four pieces of black licorice, and go brush his teeth. And then at the end of the inning, when he's going back out on the field, he would shove four more pieces of black licorice in his mouth, chew them the entire time he's on his field, come back, get rid of them, and brush his teeth. And he'd do this every single inning that he was playing the game, because this is the thing that's going to allow him to win at baseball. Not years of practice, not eight solid teammates out on the field with him, not great pitching, not great hitting, licorice. Licorice and brushing your teeth, that was the thing. And if that wasn't weird enough, there's this guy, Turk Wendell, who also had a lucky necklace of teeth. I think it was a teeth thing for him, teeth and the number 99 for him. But it was teeth of animals that he had hunted and killed. He took their teeth and put them on this lucky necklace, and he wore it every single time he played baseball, because this, not four pieces of licorice, not 99, not making sure not to touch the foul line, not years of training and experience, his lucky teeth necklace, that's the thing that's going to allow Turk Wendell to win at baseball. And the crazy thing is, none of you know who Turk Wendell is. Which tells you probably about how good those things worked out for Turk Wendell. It is just this weird thing that exists in human beings. And it's not just in human beings, but this idea of superstition. Psychologists have actually trained pigeons to be superstitious because they've seen a pattern of success. They think that if they do this thing, good things will happen to them. You can actually train pigeons to be superstitious. And we get these ideas in our head, this magical thinking that because I do X, the universe or God will do Y. And these superstitions creep into our thinking and into our life. We're going to see some of that in 1 Samuel today as we move in. But by way of review, just two quick points. First, we saw that in our study on Judges was a march to the bottom. And we saw that through Israel's poor decision-making, Israel's poor leadership, things just got worse and worse and worse because they were not pursuing their God. And in the first few weeks, we've seen that God has set up this character, Samuel. And through Samuel, he's going to start the journey back to the top. He's going to start rebuilding Israel back to what he always intended Israel to be. And this boy, Samuel, who's now living in the temple, has grown into a man who is serving as God's voice, as his prophet in the nation of Israel. And that's exactly where chapter 4 starts. It says, and the word of Samuel came to all Israel. This is just, if you're reading along, a reestablishment of the idea that Samuel is now the voice of God in Israel. He is speaking for God, and Israel is to listen. It says, now, Israel went out to the battle against the Philistines, and they encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Aphek. And the Philistines drew up in a line against Israel, and when the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. And you said to yourself, well, but Pastor Kyle, you said that Samuel was here and he was going to help build things back to the top. How are we going to build things back to the top? If right off the bat, Israel is still being defeated by the Philistines? That's what happens when we're on our march down, not on our way march back up. Well, I think Samuel and God is setting a picture for us in that through the book of Judges, Israel was on a downward trajectory. And God has now appointed Samuel to be the voice of God, but that trajectory is going to take time to change. They were head downward and downward and downward. And God has now established Samuel. Samuel is going to be the one who speaks for God. Samuel's the one who, if they listen to Samuel, if they follow Samuel's leadership, God is going to use that to move forward. But Samuel has just been appointed. There are still things that need to happen before we're going to see that progress begin. So Samuel, as he's writing this book, is telling us right off the bat, things didn't change overnight. It's not like just because Samuel showed up on the scene, things were just instantly better. This is going to be a process. But I can imagine how frustrating that would have been for Samuel on the front end, right? When God has called him, when God has tasked him, when God has said, if you do this, I am going to use you to lead my nation of Israel back to prosperity. And the first thing that happens is failure. That had to leave Samuel somewhat confused, somewhat discouraged, somewhat frustrated, because he said, but God, you said to do this. I did this. Why aren't we winning? And I think that's why Samuel records this for us, is so we know it wasn't all roses right off the bat. That took time for this shift to take place. What's interesting is to see Israel's response to this loss. It says, when the people came to the camp and the elders of Israel said, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Which, by the way, great question. They realize they've lost, and they realize that it's the Lord who has allowed this to happen, not the Philistines. It's their answer that ends up causing a problem. Because it says, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of Israel, or power of our enemies. So we see their response here. They've lost the battle, and they get amongst themselves and are like, why did we lose? Why did God let us lose? Why is this happening? And their response is, it's the Ark. It's the Ark of the Covenant. If you don't know the Ark of the Covenant was something that was given to the nation of Israel as they were traveling through the wilderness, and it was where God was said to dwell amongst Israel. In fact, during the day, there would be a pillar of cloud, and at night there'd be a pillar of fire that appeared above the Ark of the Covenant, and they would follow that cloud, and they'd follow that pillar of fire because it was a representation. It was God leading his people. And wherever that cloud stopped, or wherever that fire stopped, that's where they put the Ark, because that's where God was. And the Ark was to be there with God. And the last place the cloud or the fire stopped at this point was Shiloh. Shiloh is where God said he was going to be. That's where they put the Ark, because the Ark is where God was. And the Ark needed to be where God was. At this point, Israel, having lost this battle, said, you know what? You know what went wrong? We didn't have that Ark. The thing that's disturbing is they missed the point entirely of what the Ark represented. Because what he says, what they say is, let us bring that Ark from Shiloh, that it might come among us, and that it might save us from the power of our enemies. See, as you think about how the pillar and the cloud moved through the wilderness, that was where God was. And they took this Ark, this hunk of gold, this very pretty box, and they put that Ark where God was. Now they're going to go and take that Ark away, and they're going to put their trust and their faith in it, this pretty gold box, to save them. What they're going to find is this box has absolutely no power on its own. The box isn't going to do anything. It says, so the people sent to Shiloh, and they brought the Ark of the Covenant from the Lord of the Lord of Hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. And as soon as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout so that the earth resounded. Big thing to point out right here in the middle, it's this thing called foreshadowing. If you remember back to last week, God gave a very specific prophecy. He actually named two people by name, Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Israel, and or the two sons of Eli. And he said, these two sons of Eli, this is going to be a sign to you. they are going to die. They're going to die on the very same day. And when that happens, you will know God is working. When that happens, Eli, you will know that God is raining judgment down on your house. The time has come for judgment to be visited for all the sin that you have allowed to go unchecked over the years. So when Hophni and Phinehas die on the same day, Eli, you better watch out. Now we get to the next chapter, and God's going, so they went to get the ark, and they brought the ark, and guess who was with them? Hophni and Phinehas. They're at the same place with the Ark of the Covenant, about to go into battle. Anybody want to guess what's coming next? As soon as the ark comes up, everybody starts celebrating. Everybody starts shouting because their lucky rabbit's foot, I mean, their Ark of the Covenant is there in the camp with them. And they have their necklaces of teeth on. And they got their licorice in their mouth. And they're all ready to use all their superstition to go into battle. And the Philistines heard the noise and the shouting. And they said, the Philistines, not the Israelites, what does this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrews mean? And they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come to camp. And the Philistines were afraid, for they said, a God has come to the camp. The Philistines hear the celebrating. The Philistines hear the shouting and the just the joy that is coming from the other side. And their only possible assumption is they must be celebrating because God has showed up. They're not. They're celebrating because a box showed up. But the response is so loud that the Philistines can only make one assumption. It must mean their God has shown up. And they said, woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us. Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight. I love this response by the Philistines. They hear the celebration in Israel, and their assumption is, oh no, their God showed up. They've heard about this God. So much so that they don't even believe it's just one God. It must be multiple gods because of all the incredible things that he has done or they have done. They are so convinced that their God has showed up that they are terrified. They don't even get the story right, but I think that's probably by way of rumors that he struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. They probably are conflating two stories here, the plagues that they experienced in Egypt and the death of the Egyptians as they pursued them into the Red Sea as they entered the wilderness. But the Egyptians were never in the wilderness, but by the time it probably got to the Philistines, this is the version of the story that they had heard. And they are terrified. So their response, it took me 2 or 3 readings to understand what they were saying here, but it says, take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews. What they're saying is, their God showed up. We're all going to die. That's how this is going to end. Guys, we're going to go into battle against the Israelites. Every time anybody's gone into battle with the Israelites where their God was there and present with them, they died. That's the end of the story. We're going to get wiped out, but it's better than being slaves. So let's go. Man up. Let's go die together. Here we go. All right. Why is nobody lining up to go to battle? But they do. They get ready. They get excited. And they go in their minds to their death because they're going up against the God of Israel. So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated. And they fled, every man to his home, and there was very great slaughter, for 30,000 foot soldiers of Israel fell. And the Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. The Philistines understood that the power of Israel was in their God. The Israelites understood that their power of their God was in a box. And as a result, the Philistines end up winning the day. The ark, this fancy rabbit's foot of a box that Israel had, is captured by the Philistines and taken away. And God's prophecy that he delivered through Samuel in the previous chapter, Hophni and Phinehas, die on the very same day, just as God said they would. This is not a good day for Israel. And a man of Benjamin, one of the tribes of Israel, ran from the battle line, runs back to the camp. And he came to Shiloh on the same day with his clothes torn and with dirt on his head. And when he arrived, Eli was sitting in his seat by the road watching, for his heart trembled for the ark of God. Seems that Eli did seem to have an understanding of what was going on here, because he was sitting scared because he knew that the ark going by itself without the presence of God going with it meant nothing. And he seemed to have an indication that he knew this was not going to end well, because he's sitting by the road watching, waiting, hoping against hope that Israel would be victorious and that they would return the ark of God back to the presence of God there at Shiloh, because Shiloh had become the place of worship before Jerusalem. Jerusalem has not been established as their center of worship yet at this point. And his heart's scared. He's terrified. And when the man came into the city, he told the news. The city cries out. They start weeping. They start mourning the death of their army. And when Eli heard the sound of the outcry, he said, "What is this uproar? What am I hearing?" And the man hurried and came and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were set so that he could not see. And the man said to Eli, "I am he who has come from the battle. I fled from the battle today." So Eli's sitting there waiting for the ark to come home. He is 98 years old. He can't see. And what he hears is somebody come running into town, tells a group of people what has just happened, and the city cries out. And Eli, he's hearing this outcry. He's hearing this uproar of mourning, and he's like, tell me what happened. What has happened? I can't see. I was too far to hear. Come, tell me what happened. So he comes, and this young man comes to tell him what he has seen on that day. Now, there is a tradition in church. It is not a biblical, like, there's nothing in biblical narrative that tells us this, but it has long been said that this man who delivers this message is Saul, and that is going to be important in just a little bit as we study 1 Samuel. I do not know whether that's true. And if you've heard that, it might be true, but it's nothing more than a story that's been passed down. This, it's not actually here in this account. It says, "How did it go, my son?" And he who brought the news answered, and he said, "Israel has fled before the Philistines. There has also been a great defeat amongst the people. Your two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured." So after hearing the prophecy in the previous chapter, Eli is now told that this prophecy has come to fruition. God has done what God has said he was going to do. Hophni and Phinehas have died on the same day. And what that means for Eli and his family is that the judgment is at hand. Things are about to get really bad. And as soon as he mentions the Ark of God, Eli fell over backwards from his seat by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. For the man was old and heavy, and he had judged Israel for 40 years. 40 years Eli spent leading the nation of Israel, judging the nation of Israel. And Eli ends up being their next to the last judge. They have one more coming in the future. But until then, he was their final judge. And at the end of 40 years of ruling over them as their judge, this is how it ends. His family is disgraced. The Ark of the Covenant is gone. And he basically falls over, breaks his neck, and dies. That's how Eli's story ends. It's tragic. It's sad. But it's the result of, at this point, decades of permitting sin in his presence. Now his daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, who just died, was pregnant. She was about to give birth. And when she heard the news that the Ark of God was captured and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed and gave birth, for her pains came upon her. So she's so surprised, she's so hit by this just 1-2 punch of bad news that this pregnant woman, the wife of Phinehas, just goes directly into labor. And she's about to give birth. This is what it says next. And about the time of her death, not what you wanted to hear in the verse immediately following, she goes into labor. About the time of her death, so they tell you the end of the story on the front end. She's not going to make it through this. The women attending her said to her, "Do not be afraid, for you have borne a son." Yay! But she did not answer or pay attention. She named the child Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel, because the ark of God has been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her husband." So as her child is born to her, she's given a boy, a young child, and they bring the boy to her for naming and for celebration. So maybe she'd have a little bit of encouragement on this day. And she looks at the kid and she names him Ichabod. Ichabod, because there is the glory of God is gone. It would be the equivalent of a woman today giving birth, bringing the baby to the woman and say, "All right, what's the name of your baby?" Hopelessness. I'm going to name my kid Hopelessness, because there is no hope for me. There is no hope for my family. There's no hope for my nation. There's no hope for my church. There's just nothing. Everything is terrible. Everything is bad. There is no hope, and I want everyone to remember that. Every time they look at my kid, I want them to know just how bad it is. Happy Mother's Day. I did not do that on purpose. That's how bad things have gotten in Israel. And if that wasn't bad enough, it doubles down. Because then in the very last verse of the chapter, it says this, "And she said, the glory of God has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured." Judges was a march towards the bottom in Israel. Samuel is going to be the one that God is going to use to start building back. But Israel is still in the process of suffering the consequences for the choices they have made in the past. They have lost sight of who their God is. They have lost sight of what role he should be playing in the nation. And as a result of that, they are suffering consequences that they have well earned. So what? So why are we studying this passage? Why we're studying on Mother's Day is pure coincidence, but we are studying this passage because there are things that we can take out of it today. So what? Why? First, I want to say just on the front end, start where Samuel did. Don't grow weary in well-doing. Samuel was given a task, and he was told by God, God is going to do great things. Trust in that. And as he's trying to trust in that, he is seeing all this really bad stuff happening. And God, I think Samuel was trying to tell us on the front end, look, bad things happen, but we're still going in a good direction. The word of the Lord is still back in Israel for the first time. It's coming through Samuel for the first time. He's like, we are going to move in positive directions. There's just some stuff we need to take care of first. And I don't know about you, but there are times in my life, there are times in my ministry where I need to be reminded of this. Because it feels like things aren't going well. It feels like as we have heard from God and as we have sought God and as we have set direction in our church, things like reaching, teaching, growing together, things that we have said we want to be about as a church because we see that in the Word of God and we think that we are called to do that, there are obstacles that come in our way. There are barriers that come in our way. There are things that trip us up, and it can get really easy to say, man, did we just totally miss it? Is this not what we're called to do? And the reminder here is that even as you face obstacles, when you know that God has called you, when you know that God has tasked you to accomplish something, when you know that there are good things that we're supposed to be doing, don't let those obstacles keep you down. Get up. Be encouraged. God always does what God says he's going to do. He has never failed in that, not even once. So don't grow weary in your well-doing. But we may need to ask ourselves the question that Israel didn't. Is God your lucky rabbit's foot? Because see, Israel was perfectly happy going into battle by themselves until they lost. And then they were like, you know what, I'll go back and I'll get my lucky rabbit's foot, my lucky necklace of teeth, my good luck charm. We call him God. And I'll drag that into battle, and that'll be the thing. That'll be the thing that saves me. I can do it as long as I've got this lucky thing with me. And it's easy to get down on them, but how often do we do that? How often do we ride into battle? How often do we ride into confrontation? Do we ride into opportunities to talk about our God, to ministry, to helping people, And we are more than happy to do it on our own. Until something goes not our way. Until things get hard. Until things happen that we don't like. And then it's like, whoa. Let me pray about this real quick. Because now it's not going my way. That's a good response. We should absolutely turn to God in that moment. But why do we only do that after we get punched in the nose? Why don't we do that before we ever even set foot towards battle? I think sometimes it's because we get God in our minds in this place of he's my lucky charm rather than he's the ruler of my life. He's my good luck talisman rather than he's the one who literally gave his life on my behalf, who loves me more than anybody I've ever known, who is more worthy of my praise and my worship and my adoration and my focus than anybody ever has been. He's my two pairs of socks that don't match. Not the God of the universe who literally spoke everything into being. It is so easy for us to reduce God and put him inside of a box where God shows up and does what we ask him to do when we ask him to do it, and not give him his proper seat on the throne of all creation. And I think in changing how we think about our God, getting him out of the box and onto his throne will make all the difference in how we go about our life. And then finally realizing that sometimes God does allow bad things to happen. Sometimes God does allow pain to come into our lives, right? In Israel's case, that was judgment upon Eli's family. In other cases, he allows sin to exist. And sin brings pain. Sin brings death. Sin brings things into our life that cause hurt so that we have the choice to whether or not we choose to love God or whether or not we choose to let sin reign. But at every step of the way, God never wastes a hurt. He may allow hurt into your life. You may be here this morning experiencing hurt because of something that he has allowed to come into your life. But know that that hurt will not be wasted if God is in it. Even in this story, as this mother is giving birth in hopelessness, as she dies, as Eli dies, as Eli's sons die, as Israel has lost the Ark of the Covenant, God is putting things in motion that through the rest of this book, he is going to redeem these hurts in such incredible ways, and he is going to leave Israel in such a better position because of these hurts. These hurts are going to directly lead to their benefit. I encourage you today that if you're feeling those hurts in your life, that you can trust that if God is in it, they will not be wasted. God is more than a lucky charm. God is the person who will see us through those hurts to show us why we should never grow weary in well-doing, but instead put himself on the throne as we pursue him rather than our own designs. Let's pray. God, I thank you that you are a God who can be trusted. That when things look like they are out of control, you are not out of control. When things look painful, you are right there with us. And you are doing something. And God, it may be beyond our lifespan to see what it is that you are working out. But I thank you for all the ways that we can see that you've worked in the past, to know that we can trust you. You have never failed once. Father, we thank you for that in your son's name. Amen.